in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Thursday, August 21st, 2014. And today we're talking about how to learn. There's so many things that you and I want to learn. But it's not going to do us any good if we spend our time ineffectively. So how do we learn so that we make it stick? Well, that's the name of a new book co-authored by our guest today, Henry Roediger. It's called Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. Henry Roediger is a psychology researcher and James S. McDonald Distinguished University Professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He's published over 200 articles and chapters on various aspects of memory. He's a Guggenheim recipient. He's past president of the American Psychological Society, and it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Roediger to the program. Professor Roediger, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure.
This book, Make It Stick, is of general interest, I think, but it's also, I think, going to be of interest to my audience. I have in my audience a lot of lifelong learners, people who are not satisfied with their formal education. They want to keep learning. They want to learn more history. They want to learn economics. They want to learn a lot of things. And you are giving practical advice backed up by research suggesting how they ought to use their study time to be most effective. And what you're doing in this book, Make It Stick, is overturning quite a bit of the conventional wisdom as to how we go about learning. Now, you must, when you look at the traditional classroom then, be pulling your hair out when you see some of the practices that people are pursuing or the way people cram for exams. What are we getting wrong about learning?
Well, that's a big question, of course. Let me give you some insights. Let me back up just slightly and say, why is it that we're doing things wrong about learning? And normally what we can perceive is exactly is what happens immediately. And so if I study something, let's say one thing we recommend against in the book is what students often do, which is simply to reread information. They'll read a chapter, they'll underline it, say, they'll go back and reread their underlinings. And that's not terrible. You learn something from doing that, and you have to start with reading. But there are just many better strategies to use. But if you take a test right after reading something, you do well on the test. The problem is that you forget it very rapidly, and you can't realize that unless you test yourself much later. And so we advocate strategies that would be effective for long-term retention, not just getting through the test a couple of days from now. One of those is what we call retrieval practice. It's basically testing yourself. So instead of simply rereading a passage or a chapter in a book, ask yourself questions about it. First, ask yourself questions as you go along. How would I put this in my own words? What is the main point of this section I just read? And then later, afterwards, I encourage people simply to write questions as they go along. And then you've got, if the book, say it's a textbook, if it doesn't provide questions in the back, you've got your own set. And then you can go back when you're studying and try to practice retrieving the information. And a lot of studies have shown that this kind of retrieval practice, producing it yourself, bringing it out of your mind, aids long-term retention much more than repeated rereading. And that's true even if you can't remember everything. So retrieval practice is one effective way. I could go on, but let me just stick with that theme for a moment, because one thing we see about education is people use a metaphor of getting information into your memory. People talk about that all the time, how learning is getting information into mind. Well, that's part of it, but you've also got to learn to use the information when you need it. And what retrieval practice does is to foster a kind of active learning so that when you need information, you can have it at your mental fingertips, as it were. And students, when we talk about retrieval practice, they know about it. I mean, that's how you learned your multiplication tables. You had flashcards. You know, you had 6 times 8 on one side. You had 48 on the other, and you would look at one side and try to remember it. And if you couldn't, you'd turn it over. And so people know about it, but they don't use it as effectively as they should as they move up the educational ladder.
Now, of course, in the classroom setting, it's easy to get retrieval practice in the form of regular testing. But if you're engaged in the work of an autodidact, it might not be as easy. One of my friends recommends something he calls lecturing to the wall. You read a few pages of a dense book, and then you turn to the wall and try to lecture on it for 5 minutes. Is this in some way comparable to the strategies that you're recommending?
That's exactly the strategy we're recommending. And then the trick would be, if it's something you really want to remember, if this is a particular passage you want to remember, don't just do it once immediately after you read it, but write that question down that would make you lecture to the wall, and then do it again 2 days later, and then do it again a week later. If it's something you really want to retain, you need to do it repeatedly to make sure you have it. Just once or twice is not enough, our studies show. We are tricked into thinking we have the illusion that we really know it and that we'll never forget it. But in fact, we will unless we continually practice it. But I think your friend's strategy is exactly right.
Is there any difference in retention between doing the old-fashioned underlining in the book and then reviewing the underlined portions, between that and actively taking notes, or is it more or less still the same strategy?
No, taking notes is excellent. And as I mentioned, if you were to read and go through and create questions and then answer your own questions later, that would be effective too. Note-taking is definitely effective. There's actually a very interesting study that came out earlier this year by some psychologists at UCLA, which showed kind of counterintuitively that if you're in a classroom setting, so you're a student, again, this doesn't necessarily apply to all lifelong learners, but to people who, say, are watching a MOOC or something and trying to learn from that, these authors showed that taking notes by hand actually is better than taking notes on a computer.
Oh.
Even though when you take notes on a computer, you tend to write more down, but the idea is when you take notes by hand, you know you can't copy everything. And so what it does is to force you to think hard about it, to crystallize the knowledge, to put it in your own words. And so that is a very good activity. It's very hard work to take good notes, as most of us know from school. And they said that what they think happens is that when you take notes by computer, it's kind of like you're taking dictation.
Right.
And so you just start writing things down, but you don't think hard about them. You kind of write down literally what the person is saying, the professor on, say, the MOOC, without having them to think hard about it. And then even when you're permitted to restudy your notes, the people who do it by hand remembered more, tested better, knew more of the information than those who did it by computer. And so I'm encouraging my students not to bring their computers to class. Some of my co-professors, I haven't gone this far, banned computers from their class so students can't be doing Facebook and writing emails as well as trying to take notes.
Oh, I can't believe there are any students out there doing that.
I'm afraid you're...
I've been out of the classroom for many, many years, but long before this feature of the classroom reared its head. I also find interesting, and this seems to follow on what we've said thus far, that having the student being forced to supply an answer of his own seems to be more effective in the long run than having him choose from a series of choices, as in a multiple choice quiz.
That's true. That's still debated a little bit in the literature, but at least some of the research that I did showed that if you do it yourself, if you produce it yourself, it's better than if you simply select from choices. But even multiple choice tests do benefit retention more than rereading, some studies show. So, and of course, there are all kinds of multiple choice tests. Some are just very basic factual, you know, what year did so-and-so happen in? Well, that's probably just about like reading. But other multiple choice tests, if the creator does a good job, is makes you think hard. They make you draw inferences. And so those kinds of multiple choice questions probably do foster this good kind of learning we're talking about. But it's difficult to write those questions, as all professors know.
Now, another point that surprised me is the point that you make about what's sometimes called massed study, just focusing repeatedly on the same material. You're just diving into this material again and again, deeper and deeper into the same material. You would think that would be the way to master something most effectively, and it turns out it's not.
No, it's much better to space things out and to interleave them, not to just study the same thing over and over. That when you focus single-mindedly just on one thing, you have, and people like to do that. If you give students a choice, they say that's the way they prefer to study, because you make very rapid gains in this way. But also then we show you get rapid losses, you get rapid forgetting afterwards. It's much better to make learning a bit more difficult by spacing it out. So you study something for a while, then study something else, a different topic, maybe a third topic, and then come back to the first topic. That has been shown in just dozens of studies over the, maybe hundreds of studies by now, over the last century, to be the most effective way of learning. But it's very difficult in some types of classes to do that, because we naturally, in education, you cover, you know, if it's algebra, you cover one topic and then you go to the next topic and so forth. But then at some point you need to interleave and to mix up your practice, and so you recognize all different kinds of problems and you can do it out of context. There was a study switching away from educational things. There was an interesting study done by a psychologist studying a baseball team at a California university, and they had them practice hitting fastballs, curveballs, and so forth. And they either practiced 15 of the same thing in a row, or they intermixed them. They just never knew what was coming, which is what actually happens in a real game. And what they showed was that the hitters, as they practiced, if they knew what was coming, if they knew, you know, here are the 15 fastballs, now they're the 15 curveballs, now they're 15 changeups. Well, their learning curves for hitting were much better. They showed better performance compared to a group that didn't know what was coming on any pitch. But then when they went to and looked at actual performance in games, the group that learned by mixing up performance was much better, because they were practicing it the way they would actually see it happen in the game. So when you have this kind of mass practice, it gives you the illusion that you're learning a lot and that you're doing better. You are doing better. It's just that when you put them in game conditions where everything is all mixed up, then they don't do as well. They can do well if they know a fastball is coming, but not if they have no idea what pitch is coming. And so it's kind of the same in the classroom. If you mix up your studying of various topics, if you're a student, it's much better than just pounding in the same thing over and over and over, cramming, if you will.
Yeah, now that is interesting, and that's an interesting extension to it, the baseball example. Now, I'm curious to know the extent to which the kinds of things you're saying in Make It Stick are, let's say, the conventional wisdom among scholars who engage in this kind of work. A lot of times the general public will believe one thing, and then it turns out that professional scholars who work in that field, they don't believe any of this. They believe the opposite of what the public believes, and the public is always surprised to learn that they're believing something that runs contrary to expert opinion. Is that the case here, or is expert opinion maybe divided and you guys are just taking a stand with one position as opposed to another?
Well, in education, you can find people advocating for most anything.
I suppose so.
that's part of the problem. What we try to do, though, is base all of our conclusions on a massive amount of scientific evidence that have been developed over, in some ways, the last 100 years, like the spacing work I just talked about. In other ways, the last 10 or 15 years. But everything we recommend in our book, Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning, has been verified in usually dozens of scientific experiments. And what we've tried to do is to do things in a laboratory setting under kind of artificial conditions. But in many cases, we've also done work, my colleagues and I here at Washington University have done work in actual classrooms. We had the good fortune of finding a middle school and a high school not far from St. Louis, in Columbia, Illinois, in fact. And they allowed us to go into their classrooms and do research. And so we have verified many of the principles of the book in actual classroom settings, like the retrieval practice principle I talked about.
Now, you and your colleague, Professor McDaniel, did an interesting thing when putting this book together. You enlisted the aid of Peter Brown, a novelist, and I think a lot of scientific work that's pitched to the general public could benefit from this. What were you shooting for there?
What we were shooting for, if Mark McDaniel and I had written the book by ourselves, it would have been way too academic and full of jargon and that kind of thing, the kind of thing academics write for each other. Sadly, it doesn't translate well in the general public, but Peter Brown is a novelist, as you point out, I knew. He also has written a nonfiction book or two, and so he was very interested in learning, so we had to explain it to Peter, and then he found many people, there are many stories interwoven into the book about a neurosurgeon, about a pilot, where people had some either stumbled on these principles themselves or their work showed that they had implicitly understood them. So we Peter went out and interviewed many people, some professors, but mostly people in other walks of life who intuitively knew these principles. He also found a medical student in Georgia who had written me and to Mark, too, saying he wasn't doing well in medical school. He was looking at the science of learning, and he asked us for advice, and then he went to nearly the top of his class by following the advice that we now provide and make it stick. At that point, we were providing it by writing him emails. And so the book has many of these kinds of successful stories of lifelong learners, some students, but mostly lifelong learners, and how they kept successfully learning throughout their lives. There's one study of a gardener, for example, in Minnesota, who just started working away at this and how she overcame many obstacles and now is a lecturer on gardening techniques. How did she learn all of this starting from nothing? And Peter tells her story, quite an interesting one, as well as that of many other people. So I think the book is doing well because it appeals not just to academic types. We don't have lots of tables and graphs of numbers. We have stories that exemplify the research, but then we also describe the research, Peter, especially in more lay terms than Mark McDaniel and I would have used had we tried to write a book like this just on our own.
Well, it's a very good balance, and of course, it still packs enough scholarly heft behind the prose of the work of a Peter Brown that it's still published by Harvard University Press, and as you say, it does seem to be doing quite well. I want to direct people to the website that you guys have set up for the book. It's makeitstick.net. You can find out all about it. You can look at the contents, testimonies. You can, of course, buy it at that site, which is also important. Any parting words before I let you go today?
No, but I think the book is intended for lifelong learners, so I hope many people in your audience will find it of interest, and we'd love to hear their stories, too, so they should feel free to write us. The address is on that website you just gave.
Well, I'm definitely going to urge my listeners to check out makeitstick.net or to go to Amazon directly and take a look at Make It Stick and read it, because there isn't a whole lot of benefit to we can't believe in the labor theory of value in this sense, that as long as you just do a lot of work, you're going to retain a lot of information. You have to work smartly, and this book will show you how to do just that. Professor Roediger, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody, a few quick things before I let you go. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the Ferguson situation with Will Grigg, who, of course, is the master when it comes to topics like this. So we'll welcome Will tomorrow. I'm going to be in Ireland in May 2015, and I'm trying to get a sense of whether it would be worth doing a small event while I'm there. If you live in Ireland, particularly around Dublin, but really anywhere, drop me a note if you wouldn't mind. I'll keep you on a list. Don't worry, I'm not going to spam you. It's just a list that I'll use when I'm about to show up there. I'll send out a note to everybody saying, here's the event if I decide to have one. You can contact me on my personal site, tomwoods.com, on the contact page, tomwoods.com/contact. Just let me know that you're there, and we'll see. Maybe we'll wind up putting something together. Tomorrow, Jordan Page is doing a private concert at our house. You guys all remember Jordan Page, I'm sure, from the Ron Paul campaigns, but of course also from the episode we did with Jordan Page earlier this year. Jordan Page, musician of the Ron Paul Revolution. So that's going to be fun over at our house in Topeka. It's one of the things that makes Topeka nice is the fact that Jordan Page is coming there tomorrow night. Then finally, my book is finished, and the foreword by Ron Paul is in. I'm just about to send it out now to the CreateSpace people and the Kindle Direct Publishing people. I've never done self-publishing before. I may never do it again for all I know, but I'm just giving it a try. It's going to be called Real Descent with a juicy subtitle, the idea being that we don't have real dissent in America. We have two possibilities presented to us, Democrats and Republicans, but they all share so many of the same premises in common that you don't really have the opportunity for real dissent if you are locked in that box. So normally the question is, should we bomb or should we just starve that foreign country? Well, I think that does not exhaust the possibilities. Should we tax people at 40% or 39.8%? I don't think that exhausts the possibilities. Should the Fed inflate or should the federal government borrow more? I don't think that exhausts the possibility. So my book is a book of real dissent from a libertarian point of view. So that'll be coming out soon. And of course, everybody who has been supporting the program through the Supporting Listeners program will get the Kindle version as just part of their package. Lots of other goodies forthcoming for those of you who are helping out the show in that way at supportinglisteners.com in the coming weeks. And of course, a big, big thank you to those of you who are helping out the show by making your Amazon purchases through the Amazon widget that you'll find at tomwoodsradio.com. That little voice in your head saying, hey, how about that guy who does that show every day? That voice that you're hearing when you're about to buy that thing on Amazon, you're about to go to Amazon, that's the voice of conscience. Actually, that's me, somehow, spiritually, saying, hey, help out the show by going to tomwoodsradio.com. And finally, man, I just can't shut up today in this closing banter of mine. I do welcome guest suggestions. I don't always act on them. I have my reasons. Some people who have some, let's say, unusual scientific ideas, I'm generally not going to have them on because I'm not in a position to evaluate them. But short of that, I'm fairly game to have just about anyone on. If there's somebody you keep asking for and I keep not having that person on, rest assured, I have my reasons, but I am very, very open to guest suggestions. I have taken many, many guest suggestions and had wonderful experiences with great guests. How do you submit a guest suggestion? Do it through my website, tomwoods.com, again on the contact page, tomwoods.com/contact. Thanks for spreading the word about the show. You guys are the best advertising I have. I appreciate your support, and we will see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.